Welcome to the County Conversations Podcast, brought to you by the Florida Association of Counties Institute for County Government, with support from the University of Florida's IFAS. In this podcast, we dive deep into the diverse and dynamic world of Florida's counties with engaging interviews and thought-provoking conversations surrounding the challenges as well as successes of Florida's counties. Each episode brings you firsthand perspectives from county commissioners, government officials, community leaders, and subject matter experts who are shaping the future of our state. We explore a wide range of topics from economic development and public safety to environmental conservation and emerging technologies. Our aim here is to provide a platform for knowledge sharing, collaboration, and inspiration for county officials and residents alike. Whether you're a county commissioner, government professional, or simply interested in understanding the local government landscape, we hope this podcast provides valuable insights and practical takeaways on all things counties.
All right. Hello, and welcome to another edition of County Conversations. I'm Eric with ICG, and today we're going to talk about a subject that we probably have not spent enough time on, and that is the local role in environmental and natural resource management. Joining me today in studio is Diana Ferguson, a former FAC employee and current government affairs consultant and lawyer in Tallahassee. Also joining us remotely is Kim Tapley. Kim is a senior environmental manager with the Hillsborough County Environmental Planning Commission, where she works in the commission's wetlands division. She is also president of the Florida Local Environmental Resource Agencies, or FLERA. And I want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. So again, what I thought we would do is talk about your organization and then let that inform us on kind of this whole broad range of the environmental and natural resource management field, because I know it can cover a lot of things like stormwater management, natural resource protection, pollution prevention, that sort of thing. So Kim, you want to give us an overview of who FLERA is and kind of the history and your membership?
Yes, certainly. Thank you very much. So local governments have consistently been challenged with how to balance protecting our natural resources, encouraging and supporting economic development, and the challenge of sustainability with the increasing growth that the state experiences. So in the 1960s, FLERA was formed as this voluntary association of local environmental programs, where we share information about mutual resource concerns and solutions. So our main mission is to enhance communication, education, and advocacy for Florida local environmental protection efforts. So our membership is open to both the public and the private sectors, and we have a diverse organization of state, county, municipal agencies, and consulting firms as well. And really, our members provide a wide variety of environmental protection and land management expertise that help to maintain Florida's natural resources. We have five separate technical committees: natural resources, waste management, air committee, land, and water resources. And our technical experts help in all aspects of natural resource, complex problems, and innovative solutions for the entire state.
Diana, do you want to add anything to that?
No, that was a great summary. Good job, Kim.
Thank you.
All right. So the organization is broken into two committees. So that's maybe a good way to start. The members that you have, are they in a certain area within, you know, this committee structure you have? Do you have more that are in sort of the wetlands management versus land conservation, or is there just kind of a mix?
Well, and so the beauty about how we have our organization is if a county or a city or an organization is a member of FLERA, that means anyone in their organization is a member of FLERA. You buy membership for the entire organization. And what I tell people is you don't have to pick your favorite committee and only stick to one committee. If you have interest in wetlands and you also may have interest in water, you can do both committees. Now, with what happened in 2020, where everyone went virtual and the technology improved for these virtual meetings, we have quarterly meetings with our committees on Teams or on Zoom the only time you really have to pick your favorite committee that you want to be a part of is at our annual conference, which is in person. Other than that, you can hop around to different committees and be well informed with all the issues occurring in the state.
So let's move to Diana. Can we talk about some of the legislative priorities of FLARA since you serve as the executive director and do some of the advocacy for them?
Sure. So we do maintain guiding principles and also legislative priorities each year. Generally, our guiding principles are very similar to FACTS. We, specifically to FLARA, though, we support legislation that provides flexibility for local control of environmental protection, and we would oppose any legislation that contains unfunded mandates or preemption of home rule authority relating to environmental regulations or programs specifically. So our mission's a little more focused, but we operate under the same sort of set of guiding principles. And then each committee works to help us put together legislative priorities. As Kim mentioned, sometimes they overlap, and sometimes there's, you know, interest in more than one. They don't are always fit into neat silos, but generally the types of issues that we make priorities, we always maintain policy statements on land acquisition and management. And it's generally very much just supporting full funding of the Florida Forever program. We also support money toward local management of state and local lands. Local governments do a lot of land management work for both state and local programs. And in recent years, we've become much more focused and have dug in much deeper on issues like sea level rise and resiliency. But, you know, we do lots of other things, too. We focus on petroleum storage tank cleanup and contracting inspections, and we work to secure full funding for those programs. We also have statements on air quality, and, you know, that's something that not a lot of folks know that counties have a role in, but I think most, if not all, urban counties have delegation from the federal government related to air quality. And due to their efforts, we no longer have any non-attainment areas in Florida. And that's something that I think is pretty important that often, you know, goes overlooked, that is really due to the efforts of counties. Another area of very detailed focus is water quality and quantity. And so next session, we anticipate that we'll be supporting ratification of the statewide stormwater rule update. We'll be working on lots of other things. I think we can expect to see legislation on wetland mitigation and seagrass mitigation and lots of other water issues related to both supply and quantity. And then we also recently have taken positions on energy and net metering after the latest preemption bill a couple of years ago. And FLARA would oppose legislation that would allow electric utilities to pay solar customers less than the retail rate. So that's really a high-level summary of our priorities.
Let's talk a little bit about resiliency and sea level rise. And you and I have been around the legislative process for many years. So when do you think the switch came on? Because 10 years ago, they wouldn't really talk about this stuff. It was really in maybe some sub-programs at DEP and then some disaster mitigation programs that the Division of Emergency Management run. But now it just seems like the switch has come on and there is funding, there are programs, there is planning, there's, you know, flood hub, there's everything. So when did the switch come on and what are you seeing in terms of victories and maybe some challenges coming down the road in the area of resiliency?
Well, that's a great question. And I don't know that the switch flipped, you know, in one moment of time, that there was something that happened that caused a shift, but it happened gradually and it was fairly accelerated. And I think that the more extreme storm events we've seen over the last several years has been a very big factor in that. And, you know, I think as political administrations have changed, some folks had, you know, very strong philosophical tendencies on that issue that made it difficult. That is no longer the case. And as those, you know, folks have changed and new folks have come into those roles, we do now see both the governor and legislature much more willing to work very diligently, actually, on sea level rise and resiliency. And I think as storms have gotten more frequent and more extreme, I just don't know that we have a choice in Florida anymore. It's not something that we can really debate. I don't think it really matters why it's happening. Everyone realizes that we have very real problems and we need solutions and we need to work together on them. So it has been refreshing to see that in the last several years. And I think the the current administration and the legislature is very, very dedicated to these issues, and both the House and Senate make them a big priority. So that's been helpful for funding of environmental programs. And the current governor has been very supportive of funding for all of the environmental programs that are of interest to us. Where we continue to run into challenges, though, is on the policy side. Because, you know, I think we continue to see these bills that are preemptive relative to land use and even so many bills where there might be an environmental bill that says one thing, a land use bill that says another thing. And so for the first time last session, I think in part due to the fact that early on there was such a focus on the governor's priorities that when lots of other policy things started to come into play later in session, there was really a rush to get a lot of work done quickly. And I think some things passed that were conflicting and inconsistent, and folks didn't necessarily realize the extent of that at the time. So most recently, some of the problematic areas have been possibly unintentional or, you know, things that will require a glitch fix going forward. So while it's great that we have funding for all of these programs, sometimes the policies that are passed make it difficult to do the work. And that's in particular, I would say that's the case for water quality, because a lot of the work that's being done on total maximum daily loads and in-basin management action plans in Florida is done by local governments and counties in particular. And sometimes it can be hard to get that work done and also comply with some of the mandates and preemptions that have passed recently.
Diana, are you able to talk about House Bill 1379 as it relates to water quality?
I certainly can speak to it at a high level. It's been a little bit since I looked at that bill. that's a good example of like really good environmental legislation that just passed. And that was the Department of Environmental Protection's legislative package and is definitely going to do a lot to take a real serious look at septic tanks and where they can go. But that's actually a good example of a bill that, you know, requires local governments to take a look at their comp plans and make sure they're doing the right things to make sure that things are in the right place. But I think some of the things in other bills that passed that maybe went through different silos might end up making that a little bit of a challenge. And so, you know, there's all kinds that's a very big package. And there's a lot of, you know, new funding for environmental programs in there. And but it's very robust. And it's great to see the legislature and the governor making those issues a priority.
Kim, we're going to switch back to you and talk about a little bit on the resiliency side again, since where you're located, you were obviously affected, maybe not directly, but indirectly by Hurricane Ian, and then more recently, Idalia. And I wanted to talk about, you know, what you're seeing or what y'all have seen on the ground, on the beaches, and whether there are opportunities for some mitigation resiliency initiatives going forward.
Yes, definitely. So thankfully, we did not sustain serious damage here in my area of Tampa. There was significant storm surge, and then over in Pinellas, there was beach erosion, pretty significant beach erosion in some areas over there. What we have focused on the last couple of years locally is revising our regulation to encourage native-based solutions for shoreline stabilization projects. So try and encourage people to do living shorelines or perhaps a hybrid approach of a seawall if needed, but some plantings in front of it. We're really trying to encourage resiliency in that matter along the shoreline. I just did a presentation to the Agency on Bay Management, which has a number of different local organizations to try and spread the word that we really need to look at these creative solutions and write them in our local regulations to have almost like an easy button for these property owners to do a living shoreline. We shouldn't have a whole bunch of regulatory hoops to jump through if they want to plant, you know, mangroves along their shoreline with some riprap. So I see that moving forward, maybe at the state level, if local governments are really trying to encourage native-based solutions, that the push would come at the state level as well to maybe have some exemptions or easier permitting language for those homeowners for resiliency.
I would add to that, that natural solutions have become more and more of a focus, not just for coastal protection, but also for water quality. I mean, one of the reasons the stormwater rule is being updated is because it's become clear that the current rule isn't yielding the results that it was intended to yield. And so, you know, there are going to have to be some improvements eventually made if we're, you know, going to make progress. And one of the least expensive ways to do that is going to be through incorporating natural solutions into stormwater management systems. And so I think we're going to start to see a lot more of a focus on that as well going forward.
So without going too far down a technical rabbit hole, you said the stormwater rule was the previous one was, or current one is not sufficient. With what standards, what measures do you say?
Well, the part of the problem, I think, is that there are no numerical standards in the current rule. And so the rule also hasn't been updated in well over 20 years, and it's far past time to update it. It can be a challenge to update it though. And the new rule would include numerical standards, but that has generated some opposition with, you know, some folks in the development community saying that it's either difficult or impossible are too costly to implement those improvements. And so that's going to be a big focus of conversation is I think we do need numerical standards. How can we do it in a way, like Kim said, that balances the needs of the environment with also making sure that it's, you know, economically feasible. And so there aren't really any easy answers there, but there has been a lot of work done on that. And, you know, over time, we have just seen that the permits that have been issued for stormwater, they're just not, even though, you know, there's no direct enforcement on that because there's presumption of compliance, they're not yielding the results they were supposed to. So it's easy to go too far down into a technical rabbit hole, which I don't want to do. But globally, it's just important to note that change is coming. If it doesn't happen this session, it's going to have to happen, or eventually the federal government will get involved. And so it's going to be really important for folks to work together in Florida to find, you know, less expensive, innovative solutions to stormwater that will allow development to continue because it does have to. I mean, we can't just stop growing. So,
and maybe Kim, you can talk about this, and Diana, you can talk. But what's, you know, what are some of the challenges of implementing, you know, a local program that has to, you know, comply with some of all these other entities, whether it's at the regional level or at the state level or even the federal level?
That's a great question. Kim, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so here at EPC, we actually have delegation from the Department of Environmental Protection for single family home properties. So when someone applies to EPC for, let's say, a dock, we would look at the project for our EPC rule for our dock regulation. Then we would put our DEP hat on and we would look at the same project for the DEP standpoint. And then we also have some minor, what I would call delegation from the Army Corps, so the federal permit as well. So we would look at the project through that lens as well. So when they're getting a permit, for example, the dock permit from EPC, they would be getting one on behalf of three different agencies. And that's something that we have strived, at least in our county, for one-stop permitting. We also can do that for wetland impact projects in some aspect for single families. If they need a small wetland impact for a house, we can issue that permit on behalf of EPC and on behalf of the state for them to help them through that process.
We've been getting a lot of questions, concerns from some of our counties regarding beach nourishment and easements.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Kim, I see you shaking your head. can you give us a high level overview of what that is? We've got, you know, we've been talking with Pinellas County. They've got their, you know, proposed solutions. On one hand, I understand where the Corps is coming from on this, but I just want to hear what y'all's thoughts are.
And actually, the Florida Shore and Beach Preservation Conference is happening this week, and I know this will be a huge topic of conversation there, and a lot of our folks will be there as well. But what's happened in recent years is that the Army Corps of Engineers has changed its policy. As you're doing a federal project now, in order to move forward, you've got to get an easement from every single property owner that's involved in the project. And that did not used to be the case. It used to be much more flexible. And so now one holdout can really kind of shake the whole thing up and cause it to become much, much more difficult. And more globally, you know, a similar issue, what we've seen as it pertains to beach nourishment is just as, I don't even know what the source of this is, but as people, I don't know how else to say it, neighbors are just fighting more, right? People are not getting along the way that they used to. And so you see what things that we never really used to see, such as, you know, property owners trying to keep the public off the public portion of the beach. And so even before the Army Corps issue was a problem, we were having problems in Florida with what's called customary use. And there was legislation passed that was intended to address some of these conflicts, but ended up, I think, unintentionally making it very, very difficult to move forward. In certain cases, there was litigation that's frankly still winding down, and just lots of problems we didn't see historically. And so as folks are just not getting along on the beach, it's making it much, much more of a challenge. And that's trickled all the way up and is now reflected in this change in policy. And, you know, where historically, I think you'd see almost any property owner, any coastal property owner, more than happy to have the government come in and renourish their beach and keep it healthy. Now you've got more and more folks just not willing to do that just simply because they don't want the public on the public portion of the beach. And, you know, nourishment can certainly, you know, make that part of the beach bigger. And sometimes there are challenges with folks crossing in places that they shouldn't. And, you know, but it's this has become a really, really contentious problem. And I don't think there are going to be any easy solutions, but it's something that's making it much more difficult for the statewide beach management program as a whole.
But doesn't the state have the same standards that the Corps has been applying?
More recently, yes. Yeah. This all generated at the Corps, though. But the problem just continues to grow. And, you know, there are reasons to want to do that, of course, like you said, Eric, but if it's going to come at the expense of being able to do these projects, we're really going to be in peril, frankly, because I think a thing that folks don't talk about as much, but is really, really important, is the benefit that nourished beaches provide in storm events. And, you know, sometimes you hear folks say, oh, well, the beach just washes away. Why do you keep replacing it? Well, you keep replacing it because it is so much cheaper. And the billions and billions of dollars of private homes and public infrastructure, including roads and bridges and government buildings, all of that is protected by coastal dunes and beaches. And so it's really, really important that we continue to do it, but it's becoming much, much more difficult.
Right. And we've seen it time and time again. We have excellent examples from Hurricane Irma a couple years ago down in the Keys, where you have these natural beach areas and dune areas that have protected the infrastructure. So the science is there. The examples are there. But we really have to find a way to get these beach renourishment projects started before the next major event happens.
Well, if I'm a property owner and I'm going to benefit because my property is going to be protected, I mean, Diana, I'd want to say yes rather than no. And I think their property owners are concerned that, okay, I've lost part of my seaward boundary because of erosion. Now the federal government with taxpayer money is going to come back and restore and improve that. And I guess the property owners they're concerned that anybody can come out there, set up a tent, whatever. And that's my property. Now I can't do it anymore. I mean, I think isn't that the argument of the property owners?
Well, I mean, it is, but you know, the beaches, seaward of the mean high waterline, have always been held in trust for the public, and that's not new. And the only thing that really changes when there's a beach project is that, you know, that line is replaced with the erosion control line, which then stays. But you know, there's never been any way to keep the public off of your quote unquote land. And what's been lost over the years, though, is folks being as concerned about, you know, the bigger issues and the public good, and more folks just concerned about their own, you know, property and wanting to keep the public away from they, it's not really their beach though, right? Like, yes, there are legal disputes you can have about where the boundary is, but the public's always been able to be on the public beach, and that should continue to be a priority for everyone in Florida. So it is a little frustrating to see that, you know, these property disputes have exploded to become such a problem as they are today.
And where's the Beaches and Shores Conference?
So FSBPA this year is in Fort Lauderdale.
So far.
They'll also have a technical conference in February, and that one's in St. Augustine Beach. That's a smaller one. That's definitely more staff driven.
So the last question for both of you is, what I like to ask people on podcasts is, you know, what are some of the current or emerging issues that you believe local elected officials need to know about broadly environmental and natural resource management? So in November of 24, we're going to have probably 60 to 70 new county commissioners in the state of Florida. We like to push them through our education and certification program. And but in light of that, I mean, what, you know, we'd like to kind of give them a broad-based overview of a lot of the issues that they would confront during their first couple of months as an elected official. So that's why I want to, let me turn that over to you. What are maybe one or two issues that you would convey if you had an opportunity to do that?
What do you think, Kim?
Well, that's such a hard question, because sometimes these issues just pop up. I think my key takeaway to any newly elected official is use your staff, use your resources. You know, here at FLAIR, we have all these distinct technical groups that specialize in these different areas. So that would probably be the first thing, is to reach out to your contacts. You know who your staff are for these technical issues. Reach out to FLAIR, become a FLAIR member, join our technical group, so when these issues pop up, you can be there to address them. I think we're definitely going to see more of these issues with beach erosion, beach renourishment, you know, just like we talked about. I think it's also going to be a shoreline stabilization moving forward, all these mechanisms to deal with high frequency of storm events is really going to be top, I believe, in the years coming forward.
You know what I would say to a new local elected official? I think a lot of folks, when they come in, probably don't realize, I think they know that they have a role to play in deciding where things go, making sure that things are cited where it's appropriate. What they may not understand is how big and how important the local role is in managing and protecting things like the coastal system, water quality, all of these things, and how much they all fit together. The work that they do in terms of, you know, land development regulations and environmental protection is all very interrelated and has to be looked at holistically. And it's a lot. So, you know, I think it would probably take any local elected official, particularly, I mean, the bigger the jurisdiction, the more issues you've got, but it's going to take a couple of years to really understand the role that they play and get comfortable with that. But luckily, from what I have seen, we have incredibly good staff in the local programs in Florida. They do great work. They work together very well. They coordinate very well with the state agencies. And that makes it a lot better, right? It's a lot easier when folks are communicating well. And I think that is a strength of the local programs in Florida, is they do work together very well.
What about some of the smaller counties, particularly coastal counties, that probably don't have the resource and the staff to manage the things they need to manage? So,
well, that's one of the things that we've been talking about as a group in FLAIR, because frankly, we don't have a lot of small cities and counties who are members, but there is definitely a lot to be gained for those folks, because they do have access to the expertise of, you know, the engineers and biologists and other environmental professionals, planners and things like that in the, you know, more medium-sized and urban local governments. And so as they're dealing with problems maybe they haven't dealt with before, they definitely in the realm of FLAIR have access to folks who've been there and seen it and who can help them find solutions to complex problems. So we're hoping to see more of, you know, the smaller sized governments getting active.
All right. Well, Kim and Diana, representing FLAIR, I want to thank you both for taking some time today to speak with us on our podcast.